"'One from suspecting Drake,' Pitsfield said. "'A lie, yes, but an honourable one, given the circumstances.'
"'It would also pull the entire Royal Navy to Albion at just the moment when Drake is trying to rescue his parents,' Rutherford said.
Pitsfield stared at his hands.
"'Commander?'
Rutherford prodded. Pitsfield looked up.
"'It is the best way to save Albion. We join Drake in battling the Hroom as soon as they jump into the system, while Malthorn sets up in orbit with his own forces to mop up whatever gets past us. That seems the obvious tactical solution. Morally, I'm not so sure.'
"'We can't save Drake's parents at the expense of the whole planet,' Kate said. "'But we can look for a way to shield his escape, at least. I can imagine several scenarios by which that would be possible.'
"'Can you?' Rutherford asked. "'I confess that I'm struggling to think of any.
Admittedly, anything that occurs to me would be a long shot.'
Rutherford turned it over for a long moment, but in the end there seemed to be no way to do his duty to Albion and fully protect his old friend at the same time. Faced with that conundrum, there was only one possible choice. He touched his ear.
"'Norris, is that subspace channel ready to open?'
"'Almost. Give me 5 minutes, sir.'
"'Good. I will have the message for you then. Lieutenant,'
he said to Cates when he'd ended the call to Norris,
"'open your computer. I will dictate.'
She obeyed.
"'Ready, sir.'
Rutherford sighed.
"'One moment. I need to compose it in my head first. It isn't easy to gracefully betray a friend.'
And then he began. A sick feeling had settled into his gut by the time he finished.
Chapter 8 Two jumps after Hades Gulch, Drake was running through the subspace frequencies hoping for a message from Rutherford when Blackbeard came under attack. The ship was at the lead of a long column stretched at intervals of roughly 2 million miles to better hide the signature of his fleet. They would only draw together during the final approach to the jump point. After Blackbeard came Isabel Vargas on Outlaw, followed by Paradesses and Dunkley's sloops, Aguilar on Pussycat, and finally Katarina guarding the rear with Orient Tiger. The next jump point was only a few million miles beyond the uninhabited system star, and Blackbeard was cutting through the asteroid belt midway there. Scans had come up clean. They appeared to be alone in the system. So it was a shock when two torpedoes corkscrewed out from a cluster of asteroids a few 100,000 miles below them and to starboard. Warning lights flashed on the bridge. Barker's people were alert in the gunnery, and they launched countermeasures. Manx followed with 2 electromagnetic pulses from the defense grid. One of the torpedoes wandered off course, but the other barreled toward Blackbeard. Jane helpfully chimed in to state the obvious.
"'Torpedo impact in 4 minutes and 20 seconds. Class 2 detonation expected.'
"'It appears to be a Mark 4, sir,' Tolvern said. "'We can outrun it.'
Drake studied the data that Smythe was sending across. Mark 4s were an obsolete design, last used in the Navy more than 3 decades ago. About 15 years ago, the Admiralty had sold several thousand of them to Ladino colonies fighting a frontier brush war against the Hroom. As soon as that conflict cooled down, many of those missiles had made their way into private hands. This pair had been launched from an asteroid about 2 miles long and 1 mile wide, a rock big enough to hide a significant pirate base.
"'Not today,' he told her. "'Today we teach these people a lesson before the rest of our fleet stumbles through. Cap, bring us around. Get behind the asteroid.'
Nib Pym was off duty, leaving Cap in the pilot's chair.
"'What about that torpedo?'
"'You let me worry about suppressing enemy fire. Get us behind the asteroid.'
Tolvern sent a warning to the other ships in their fleet, while Drake told Smythe and Barker what he intended. They kept working at the final torpedo, even as Jane's updates grew more frequent and, it seemed, more urgent-sounding. 20 seconds out, Smythe disabled the torpedo by sending it a bogus command to disarm the warhead. There were benefits to facing old Navy ordnance. The torpedo slammed into the side of the ship but didn't detonate. Jane reported minimal damage. Blackbeard whipped around the asteroid from behind. It was shaped like a giant elongated potato, covered in warty eyes, one end broken off, perhaps by one of the other asteroids bumping around nearby. Lights flashed along its surface as Blackbeard flew over.
kinetic weapons, but the enemy fired too late, and they missed. Meanwhile, the gunnery had readied the main battery. As Blackbeard passed, she rolled onto her side and fired. Explosions ripped up the surface. Blackbeard was safely into space again moments later.
"How do you like that, you dumb tossers?" Cap said. "Bloody fools don't know what they're messing with."
But Drake didn't like what he saw from the aftermath. Gray plumes trailed high over the asteroid, with the larger debris settling slowly to the surface, while dust leaked into space to form a hazy halo around it. But there was no fire or debris venting out, and a scan from this distance showed nothing on the surface that would give away a base. If not for the attack, it would look no different from a million other hunks of rock floating out here. The crew of the dug-in base, whoever they were, now sat silent and unresponsive as Drake tried to hail them. No more torpedoes or cannon fire. Drake lurked nearby, waiting as the rest of the ships in his fleet slowed down and encircled the asteroid at a safe distance.
"Why did they shoot at us?" Tolvern asked.
"This is a trade lane, and we were cloaked. Bad instruments. They must have thought we were a merchant vessel traveling without escort. I'll wager they intended to disable us and then send a ship to haul us in."
It was a common pirate tactic. The survivors from the captured merchant ships would swell the ranks of the pirates until a system was fully infested and merchants were forced to chart lengthy detours. When the situation grew intolerable, the Navy would send a task force to root them out. Drake had been on pirate hunting missions before the last Froom War. Whoever these particular brigands were, they'd apparently realized the magnitude of their error, for now they sat silently, refusing his attempts to hail them. Moments later, he had Katerina and Isabel on a joint call through the viewscreen. He gave them orders.
"Orient Tiger and Outlaw will cover me with suppressing fire while I go in. Isabel, have the schooners withdraw to catch anyone who makes a run for it. Is Aguilar ready to mix it up? He can bring Pussycat in for close fire support if things heat up."
"Those fools are dug in pretty good," Katerina said. "You will need more than one broadside to hammer them into submission. Maybe it would be better if I go down while you give better suppressing fire."
"I am not looking for their surrender," Drake said. "I'm going to come in low and drop an atomic bomb on their head."
"Where did you get that?" Katerina asked.
"We've been carrying 5 warheads since the mutiny."
"And now is when you want to use them?" she asked.
"Waste of ammo, if you ask me," Isabel said.
Through the viewscreen, the older sister's mechanical eye seemed to glow with a strange blue light. "And a waste of good gear, too, what we destroy. Besides, I'm not sure that what they did warrants you nuking them."
"They're pirates," Drake said. "They attacked us unprovoked. Destroying their base would be a favor to anyone else passing this way."
"A fine opportunity for loot," Isabel said. "Dumb to pass it up." "I agree with my sister," Katerina said.
"I don't know what you're talking about, but we don't have time for it."
"Oh, come on, James," Katerina said. "Don't play ignorant, it's unbecoming. Who knows what we will find on that rock, and it's all ill-gotten gains, so we don't have to feel any guilt in liberating it."
Drake chewed this over, glancing at Tolvern, who had been listening to the exchange. She shrugged. Drake looked back to the two sisters sharing the viewscreen.
"How long would we need?"
12 hours, Katerina said.
"You think that's enough?" Isabel said. "A couple of hours to knock out their defenses, a few more to send an assault team, then the salvage after that."
"I didn't want to be greedy," Katerina said. "But sure, if James thinks we can spare a full day, why not?"
"I'll give you 6 hours, he said. "Then we're on our way."
There was some grumbling about this, but in the end they agreed. There were already agreed-upon terms for dividing loot, and it only fell on them to make sure the other ships had no objections. Given that the schooners were going to stay away from the fighting unless someone on the asteroid tried to flee, the two schooner captains readily agreed. Aguilar was even more eager to get his frigate, Pussycat, into the fight. Drake needed his best pilot, so he woke Nib Pym from his sleep cycle and ordered him to the bridge to take his place at the nav computer. Blackbeard flew above the surface of the asteroid at low elevation 3 times, searching for the entrance into the pirate base. It was well disguised, but on the 3rd pass, someone on the asteroid lost his nerve and tried to fire a missile. Barker's team was ready for it and brought the missile down before it was off the launch pad. Blackbeard retreated a few hundred miles and hammered the missile site with cannon fire, while the Vargas sisters brought their frigates in under his suppressing fire. Isabel was even more aggressive than her younger sister, scouring away the dust with her plasma engines while her guns tore chunks from the surface. Katerina found an exhaust port and dropped a pair of bombs down it. Once she had blown a hole into the fort, she landed the ship and charged in at the head of an assault team. There was a brief firefight in the tunnels, and the pirate fortress surrendered. One of Katerina's men was killed, two were wounded, and a number of enemies had fallen. Drake was relieved when Katerina called and he heard that she was uninjured. The whole fight had taken less than 2 hours, which left another four to snag whatever useful loot they could find. Drake checked again for a subspace from Rutherford. There was none, then prepared two away pods so he and an away team could supervise the looting. He brought his toughest people, led by Cap and Carvalho. They were all too eager and came to the away pod loaded with grenade bandoliers, pistols, and hand cannons. The asteroid was an old mining operation and riddled with tunnels. These tunnels were stuffed with looted goods, and the pirate crews were already tearing through boxes and drinking liquor by the time Drake arrived. A brawl broke out when someone discovered a crate of old earth brandy, and they were soon guzzling 20 guinea bottles as if they were watered-down grog. Heaven help them if they found anything valuable. His own people were staring, wide-eyed, with greed and surprise at the mayhem. Drake tapped Carvalho on the shoulder.
If you can stage-manage this foolish behavior, there will be a nice bonus in it. Can you manage without bloodshed?
Cap pushed her way in. You bet we can. Me and Carvalho will crack some skulls, you watch us. Hey, you! She bellowed. This here is a respectable operation, you hear? Put that down!
Carvalho and the two other men from Blackbeard, Mara and Lutz, waded in, elbows swinging, grabbing men and separating them. Cap started after them, but Drake grabbed her arm.
Not you, Ensign. I need you for the main business at hand.
But, Captain...
Do you really want to brawl with that rabble? There's a bigger reward if we keep our wits about us.
She stared after Carvalho and let out a wistful sigh.
Aye, Captain. Lead the way and I'll follow.
They found Katerina in the command center of the base, a room built into the gray rock, lined with computers and equipment. It looked like a subterranean version of a starship's bridge. A man sat in a chair, his hands cuffed behind him, staring straight ahead, expressionless. He had blonde hair turning dirty gray at the temples, with long sideburns, in the fashion many new Dutch wore these days. Katerina stood with her hands on her hips, questioning him in sharp tones. Next to her stood Nix, the fellow with the Gatling gun for an arm, who had once belonged to her father's crew. A dead man lay on his back a few feet away, his eyes staring at the flickering lights overhead, a small hole in his skull leaking blood. His hand still gripped a shotgun. Neither Katerina nor her companion paid the body any attention as they grilled the prisoner. The grim expression disappeared from Katerina's face as she spotted Drake.
There you are.
She stepped over the body and plunged her fingers into Drake's hair.
Come to take your plunder?
Drake glanced at Cap, whose eyebrows shot up, as she seemed to recognize the innuendo.
What the? Cap said. Oh, never mind me, Katerina said. I am having my fun with your captain, is all. He seems a little stiff, don't you think?
Yeah, better be careful about that, love, or he'll have you scraping barnacles.
Will he now? It's not his barnacles I want to scrape.
Katerina winked at Drake, and he felt his face go hot. She gestured at the man in the chair.
This is the fool who shot those missiles. He doesn't seem to recognize the trouble he is in. Name is Van Gelder.
I don't know who told you that, Van Gelder said in a light Dutch accent, but I am not responsible for this base.
He glanced sideways at the ugly fellow holding the Gatling gun to his skull.
I am just a technician.
Katerina slapped him on the side of the face.
Shut up, we know who you are. Three different people fingered you as the leader of this operation.
She turned back to Drake.
My sister is shaking them down for more information, but I thought I would have more luck if I separated Van Gelder from the others. But he's not cooperating.
so I might have to shoot him and try someone else.
Van Gelder paled. I'm telling you. He looked to Drake. Please, you look reasonable. Tell her I'm not in charge.
If not you, then who? Drake asked.
Van Gelder hesitated. A fellow named Jones from Albion.
I don't believe you, Drake said. But it doesn't really matter. We'll find what we're looking for. Those who cooperate will be treated well. Those who don't will suffer the consequences.
Katerina turned suddenly to Cap. Cut off his stones.
Huh? What?
You heard me take that knife at your side and hack off this bastard's testicles. You're not too dainty, are you? You don't look like the squeamish sort.
Sure, I guess I could, Cap said, drawing the long blade from the sheath. It had a wicked curve on one side and a brutal serrated edge on the other.
Van Gelder sprang to his feet, taking the whole chair with him as he was handcuffed to it. Katerina's man knocked him on the head with his gun barrel, and he fell on his back with a groan. Drake lifted the chair up and waited for the man to stop wincing from the blow.
Katerina, enough of that. Cap, put away the knife. We're not going to emasculate you, Van Gelder. I don't have any use for torture.
Thank you, sir, the man said weakly.
But I do not have much use for the uncooperative, either. If you don't tell me what I need to know, I will set a fire on my way out and burn out all of the oxygen, and that would be the end of the lot of you.
How do I know you won't anyway?
I'm not that sort of man. Do I look like that sort or sound like it? No, I am not. I keep the agreements that I make. Where is your ship?
Ship?
I am losing patience, Mr. Van Gelder, Drake warned.
Van Gelder furrowed his brow and seemed to come to a decision. There's an underground launch pad on the other side of the asteroid. We have two short-range scrapers armed with 5 inches. We can't jump. Neither ship has a warp point engine.
Then how are you resupplied?
We aren't. We've been hiding here for 15 months. No ships coming and going. That would have risked the whole thing. We have a pair of heavy freighters on retainer. Soon as things turned hot, we were going to call them in to haul us out together with all our goods. That was the plan, anyway.
They got hot, all right, Katerina said.
Nix chuckled and grinned at Cap, with his gold teeth gleaming. Cap winked at him.
Isabel Vargas entered the room. She was beaming with excitement.
We found the big payload. Dad would have been proud. Cap, we're going to be rich.
The older sister explained. Interrogations had turned up the motherload, 70,000 tons of partly refined platinum ore, stuffed into one of the tunnels. The pirates had captured a freighter from a different operation that had stolen the ore and was making off with it before they in turn stole it for themselves. Isabel's man was still assaying the haul, but the best guess was that the platinum, when refined, was worth 50,000 or more.
"We cannot take it," Drake said. "It's too big. There's no way to move it."
"Speak for yourself," Isabel said. "I'm sure as hell not leaving it behind."
"You can come back for it if you want to, but we're going to complete the mission as planned. We're not hauling around a bunch of dirt, and we're not waiting here while we try to locate a freighter to haul it away for us, either."
"Does that mean you'll kill the prisoners?" Isabel asked. She stared at him, her mechanical eye dilating. "Because otherwise it will be gone by the time we get back, and I'm not giving it up."
"What if I let you keep it?" Drake asked Van Gelder. He lifted a hand to stop Isabel's angry protests. "You stole it. It's yours, fair and square."
Isabel was still sputtering. "No way, that ore alone is worth more than your whole mission, and we didn't have to face the bloody Navy to get our hands on it."
"Let's say it's worth £50,000, Drake told her, for the sake of argument. That's after it's refined. It's not worth a fraction of that now. It's ore. You need to get it out of here and keep from getting robbed yourself. If you break our contract, you can bet that I'll spread the word about what you've got. Then we'll see if you can keep it."
"You're a bastard, Drake," Isabel said. She turned to Katerina. "Is he always like this?"
"He may be a bastard, but he's our bastard."
Katerina seemed amused by her sister's anger.
"Come on, James. Tell us what you propose as an alternative. Look at your woman here. She's no more happy about it than we are."
Cap had taken on a greedy, scheming look when Isabel mentioned the ore, but now she was scowling.
"It's worth 15,000, Drake said. "That's what I figure we would have left after we paid to haul it out of here, refined it, and sold it. A nice payday for our fleet, but it won't go very far once you start divvying it up. And if we get attacked while shipping it, repairs could easily eat that up."
He'd pulled the £15,000 figure out of thin air. He hadn't even seen the hypothetical platinum ore, and he had no idea how much it might cost to get it shipped and refined. But his confident tone seemed to give the others pause.
"Van Gelder," Drake said, "if you give me 15,000 worth of bullion, supplies, and weaponry, I'll let you keep your ore, your base, and whichever of your people wish to stay behind."
"You've done 15,000 pounds of damage already," he grumbled, "and killed 20 people at least. That's half my crew."
"And you fired the first shot," Drake shrugged. "But bygones will be bygones. Give the word and the looting stops now. We'll make an assessment and you can help us load our ship with what we select."
He turned to Isabel and Katerina.
"Does this sound reasonable? You keep our contract, you get your share of the 15,000, and everybody leaves happy."
Isabel was still grumpy, but Katerina reminded her that the whole operation had only worked because Blackbeard and Orient Tiger were there to pound the pirate redoubt. She'd have never done it alone. As for Van Gelder, he was not in the best negotiating position. Compared to Drake setting the base on fire on his way out, he seemed to think it was a good offer.
"Good," Drake said once all parties were agreed. "We're 4 hours into this operation. That leaves us 2 hours to get the loot and go."
The agreement didn't mean that Drake needed to offer the best rates to Van Gelder and the surly people under his command. The man's surviving crew kept hauling out various stolen goods, which Van Gelder then placed an absurdly high value on. Drake nodded seriously, listened to Cap, Carvalho, and the Vargas sisters estimate its true worth, and then took a 50% discount on top of that.
"Don't try to con me, Mr. Van Gelder," Drake said, when the man grew angry and threatened to stop cooperating. "You would never be able to sell these goods for their full value anyway."
"This is robbery."
"No, it's retribution. Robbery is what you attempted when you fired those torpedoes unprovoked. Time is running out, so get moving."
During all of this, Katerina's crew had located the fortress's safe. Drake only took a 10% discount on gold and silver coins against the 15,000 Van Gelder owed. That seemed fair. They ended up with 6,500 pounds worth of guineas, guilders, and doubloons, plus a bunch of goods. These included the easily transportable, like liquor and foodstuffs, to the bulky. Torpedoes, 100-kilowatt laser, Drake was thinking of Apex and the aliens' energy weapons, spare pterillium plating, and a 6-inch cannon that Paradis took as partial payment at Drake's encouragement. Paradis's schooner could use an upgrade to her weak offensive capabilities. Aguilar, whose ship was already bristling with weapons, took another cannon, although when and where he would install it Drake couldn't imagine. They also took on a dozen new crew members, some of Van Gelder's more reliable-seeming people, spread among the various ships. 11 men and women stayed behind, including Van Gelder, gloomily settling in with what remained of their base and their diminished pile of loot. 6 hours. Minor damage, 1 dead, and 2 wounded. 15,000 pounds worth of bullion and goods. The Vargas sisters had been right, after all. The little pirate fleet was in a jubilant mood as it approached the next jump point. Drake struggled to keep the ships in line, insisting that they go through in the proper order. 4 of the pirate ships obeyed him, but Dunkley raced ahead in his schooner, and rather than chase him and leave the slower ships behind, Drake let him go. Dunkley jumped first. Tolvern cursed and suggested they knock him around a bit with the deck gun when they got to the other side. Teach him a lesson. Blackbeard came through next, with the other ships following closely behind. He emerged from the jump, less confused than usual, already remembering who he was and what he was doing by the time Tolvern lifted her head and blinked groggily at him. And a good thing, too, there lurking on the other side was a Hroom fleet, 6 mighty sloops of war, their serpentine batteries hot and already firing on Dunkley's schooner.
Chapter 9. HMS Dreadnought filled the port window of Captain Rutherford's away pod, long and black and bristling with guns. The bridge on the foredeck was a blue light that looked like a single unblinking eye. From this angle, Dreadnought looked more like a monster, some creature of the deep, than a battleship, and Rutherford was hurtling toward its mouth. There were 8 molded seats in the pod, but the only other occupant was Catherine Cates, who sat to one side, hands on the straps of her restraints, staring at the blinking instrument panel opposite, her jaw clenched. For a woman who had raced through the void in a little tin can of a torpedo boat, she'd seemed surprisingly anxious about climbing into the pod, and her anxiety had not abated since Vigilant launched her at Dreadnought. She turned and seemed to notice Rutherford studying her.
"It's not claustrophobia, sir."
"No?"
"No, sir. There's no engine on this thing, that's what scares me. I don't like being fired off like we were a cannonball."
"We have been launched on a pre-programmed trajectory. Dreadnought already has the net out for us." He pointed to the schematic on the pod console, showing the battleship's spacehook.
90 seconds to docking," the computer said. It was the sophisticated male baritone chosen by Rutherford for Vigilance computer. The crew called him Simon. Rutherford found Simon's voice calming at a time like this, but Kate's didn't unclench her jaw.
"What if we miss?" she asked.
"Impossible."
"It's not impossible, it happens. Someone isn't paying attention or there's an emergency."
"Yes, I understand. I spent 17 hours in a misfired away pod only a few months ago."
"Yes, sir, during the Ajax mutiny, wearing nothing but your bathrobe, sir. Everybody knows that."
Rutherford scowled at the thought of fleet gossips laughing over his humiliating capture at the hands of Jess Tolvern, dragged naked from the shower, tossed bathrobe, and shoved in an away pod with several other prisoners of the mutiny. "Then you know what happened," he said. "I sent a distress signal, and eventually someone tracked me down and rescued me. It was an annoyance, nothing more."
"Yes, but imagine if you'd called for help and there had been a malfunction in the computer. The call doesn't go out. You're in a 6x8 egg with no engines, no way for anyone to find you, as you keep flying and flying until the heat death of the universe."
Rutherford scoffed. "Has that ever happened in the history of the fleet? I don't mean an escape pod of a fighter or a torpedo boat, but an actual away pod."
"It has, sir. There were several pods lost in the Third Room War, including one carrying a destroyer captain. After his ship was crippled and he had to eject, they never found him. Wherever he went, he's still going. Long dead, of course, but that doesn't make it any less horrifying."
"Escape pods in battle? This is not either of those things."
Rutherford gave her a sharp look.
"I thought you said you weren't a military historian. How do you know this?"
"I don't like this feeling where I'm not in control. I want something with an engine, that's all I'm saying."
"Are you worried about the Admiral? Don't be. I will make the proposal, but if he doesn't accept it, you'll be back on my bridge, no harm done."
10 seconds to docking," Simon said. The net caught them and hauled them in, but it was only when the two officers were welcomed through the airlocks by a pair of young ensigns that Kate's seemed to relax. Rutherford glanced at her, and he could see her smoothing her face, calming herself like a woman about to enter battle. By the time they entered the lift and she turned to face the doors, all sign of her jitters was gone. Rutherford nodded to himself satisfied and turned toward the doors opening onto the upper deck. Dreadnought's enormous bridge could have held Kate's old torpedo boat, and Rutherford caught her eyes widening in surprise. There were 3 sub-pilots to assist the master pilot, a separate science station with the bank of consoles and arrays for the tech officers, and 6 communication specialists. Then there were liaisons for the gunnery, engineering, and the hospital, plus a separate station for the Royal Marine Commander. The Lord Admiral had vacated the helm and sat at a small table with several adjutants. He dismissed them as Rutherford and Cates approached. The 2 officers from Vigilant remained standing while Malthorn scrolled through some report or memo, rubbing at his bushy sideburns with his free hand. At last, he gestured for them to sit. He studied Kate's, and to her credit she didn't flinch or look away, but met his gaze coolly. During that business on the away pod, Rutherford had begun to question his decision, but he had been regaining his confidence in her since arriving on the battleship.
"You have read my report, sir?" Rutherford asked.
Malthorn turned his lizard-like gaze in Rutherford's direction.
"Yes, you have sent a number of them. I must confess to being baffled by your behavior."
"Sir?"
"Starting with your refusal to obey my orders to return to Griffin Shoals to pursue the traitor, an act of insubordination."
Rutherford bit back an angry retort. He had disobeyed orders because he had discovered a new and hostile alien race, and Drake had not been where the Admiral thought he was anyway.
If Rutherford had raced back with Harbrake and the rest of the task force, he wouldn't have found Blackbeard, as Malthorn well knew by now. "With all due respect," Rutherford began, though he felt no respect at the moment, "I had information to which the Admiralty was not yet privy."
"And then you met Drake in person. You didn't capture or kill him, but let him go on his merry way."
A touch of anger clouded Malthorn's voice. "He had just saved my life, and there was a pirate frigate guarding his flank. I decided that gaining information was more important than bringing him to justice."
"Did you make an attempt, at least?"
"No attempt was possible."
"So you say."
Malthorn grabbed a file of papers and took out a sheet, which he slapped on the table.
"Now you offer this claim. What am I to make of it?"
He'd thrown down the lengthy memo Rutherford had written in response to the subspace from Drake about the Froom Death Fleet. Rutherford didn't need to read it. He'd carefully composed it before sending and had studied the words for the past few days, until he'd memorized them in preparation for this meeting. "You have not yet shared your intentions for this fleet," Rutherford began carefully, "but there are at least two suicide task forces from the Froom Navy approaching the homeworlds. We must assume that they are going directly to Albion."
Why must we assume any such thing? Maybe they are on a reconnaissance mission, or maybe Drake is lying. Maybe he met the Froom and has thrown in with them. This could be a feint to force us to retreat from the frontier.
Now why would Malthorn think Drake had met the Froom? Rutherford hadn't breathed a word about the sugar antidote that his old friend had liberated from Malthorn's estate.
"I do not agree, Admiral," Rutherford said. "Drake is a traitor, and of course we will eventually bring him to justice."
"Drake is not the traitor." No, the traitor was right in front of Rutherford, wearing the crown and star insignia of Vice Admiral on his shoulder and a sneer on his face.
"But Drake is telling the truth about the Death Fleet," Rutherford continued. "I saw a second fleet which confirmed it. There is no other reason for them to be so far from their defensive positions."
"You would stake your career on it?"
Malthorn demanded.
"Yes, sir."
"Very well. Then if you say it, it must be true. Let us suppose, for the moment, that you are correct. There are a pair of Death Fleets. Why target Albion? Why not Saxony or Mercia? They are less well protected. They would be more easily destroyed."
The answer was so obvious as to be self-evident, and Rutherford only just managed not to snarl the answer. He kept his tone measured. "There are 20 million people on Saxony, and less than 30 million on Mercia. Destroy them and you destroy nothing. Destroy Albion and the war is over." Malthorn removed a pipe from his coat pocket. He packed it with tobacco from a tin, lit it, and puffed in silence for several seconds, a thoughtful expression on his face. Rutherford took that to mean that the danger had passed, that the Lord Admiral was no longer going to crush him for insubordination.
"I do not like a defensive war," the Admiral said at last. "Do you know how we lost Wessex in the Third Froom War?"
Rutherford didn't, or rather he had a vague knowledge that the Froom had landed ground troops and burned the cities of the colony planet to the ground. The planet of Wessex was still there, waiting to be recolonized, but there were too many jump points into the system, making it difficult to defend. And since there were still millions of square miles of fertile land on Albion, Saxony, and Mercia to settle, the colonization effort would have to wait for a future, more peaceful time.
"Well," Malthorn pressed, "do you? Don't tell me your education is that deficient."
"Lieutenant Cates is a better historian," Rutherford said. "Perhaps she understands what you are searching for."
He nodded at her. Cates frowned, and for a brief moment he thought he'd overplayed his hand. If she'd been telling the truth and really did know little of military history, both of them would be left dangling. "During the Third Froom War," Cates began, "the Admiralty ordered a defensive cordon around the homeworlds. An alien fleet slipped through and attacked Albion. While we were fighting them in the Albion system, a second fleet attacked Wessex and landed 50,000 troops while their sloops bombarded the surface from orbit. Queen Ellen ordered the survivors to evacuate."
"Very good," the Admiral said. "After we lost Wessex, the Queen ordered the fleet on the offensive. After that, we never lost another significant battle in the war. Our mistake was being too timid from the first. Never fight a defensive war against the Froom.
That is what we learned. They can attack, but they have no mind for defense.
The way he spoke, it was as if Malthorn had been leading the fleet himself. But the Third Hroom War had ended decades ago, when the Admiral must have been a child.
That is the purpose of my fleet, Rutherford,
Malthorn continued.
I won't use it to huddle timidly in orbit around Albion and repeat the mistakes that lost us Wessex.
So we will penetrate Hroom space again? Rutherford asked.
Yes, we'll bypass the frontier, ignore the outer Hroom systems, and seize this.
Malthorn pulled up a map of the sector on the table console. It showed the Albion systems in blue, the Hroom as a much larger swath of red, and the Ladino, New Dutch, and Frontier systems as a tranche of yellow, separating the two. There was a blue dot deep in Hroom territory, which the Admiral pointed to now.
Our spies say that the local government on this Hroom planet has collapsed, Malthorn said. But it still has a functioning space elevator and a relatively temperate climate for human occupation. We will seize the planet, Colonel Fitzgibbons will reinforce it with 600,000 marines, and we'll hold it as a forward operating base until we win the war. Take the fight to the heart of the Empire.
It was a breathtakingly audacious plan, but Rutherford couldn't see the point. Albion had plenty of land and resources already, and even under optimistic scenarios, it might be centuries before the kingdom needed the territorial gains Malthorn was talking about. The expedition must be about slaving and the sugar trade, but these were weak justifications for another brutal war.
"Look at my fleet," Malthorn said. 6 cruisers, 18 corvettes and destroyers, 33 torpedo boats and light frigates, plus troop transports, and Dreadnought, the mightiest warship ever built. There's no need to hide, no need to sneak through. Let them come. Nothing can resist us."
Rutherford couldn't hold his tongue any longer.
"It is madness."
"Explain yourself, Captain."
"We will take this planet, all right. And while we do, the Hroom will turn Albion into a sea of radioactive glass. They are not trying to defeat our navy, Admiral. They're trying to annihilate the Albionish people. Take the fleet, go back and meet them."
"And if you are wrong? If your traitor friend has lied to you?"
"Then I am wrong and suffer the consequences," Rutherford said. "Your war is delayed a few months. Is there serious harm in that?"
"A good deal of harm. Do you know how many thousands of pounds have already been spent from the Exchequer to get this fleet assembled and in place?"
"A large sum, I imagine. But it would be rather more expensive to see the Exchequer destroyed by the Hroom."
"You have made your point," Malthorn said.
"Yes, sir."
Rutherford sensed an initial victory. He needed to discipline his tongue to see it secured.
"How long until the death fleets arrive in Albion space?" Malthorn asked.
"According to my calculations, at least a fortnight," Rutherford said. "Perhaps longer, depending on how circuitous a route they take. My pilot says that it will take us 12 days to return to Albion by the most direct route. We can beat the Hroom there, but only if we depart shortly."
"That shouldn't be a problem," Malthorn said. "I've sent Harbreak to clean up the pirate nests in the shoals while we're here, but as soon as he returns we can set off. Let Drake help us fight the Hroom, then deal with him on our own terms."
Yes, there was that. By sharing so much information with the Admiral, Rutherford was inadvertently leading his old friend into a trap. Time to rectify that error if he could.
"Your fleet has offensive capabilities," Rutherford began, "but you are lacking the leadership to execute your battle plan. That is your fatal flaw. Without better leadership on our side, the Hroom may still break through. That goes double for your proposed invasion."
The pipe dangled from the Admiral's mouth.
"Excuse me?"
"Not your leadership, Lord Admiral," Rutherford said hastily. "But you lack captains with sufficient energy and understanding to prosecute the war. Most of them are no more imaginative than their Hroom counterparts."
Left unspoken was that Malthorn had given most of those men their commissions. He had stacked his fleet with loyalists. He'd even replaced much of Vigilant's own crew, and there was no doubt in Rutherford's mind that the fleet was less battle-ready as a result. Malthorn took a puff on his pipe, seeming to relax as he realized the slight had been unintentional.
"What do you suggest?"
offer an olive branch to James Drake.
James Drake is a traitor.
He is misguided, I will concede that. And he is a proud man, like I am, Admiral. As is, I dare say, any commanding officer who is worth anything. But if you were to free his parents from York Tower, return their lands, and give Drake back his commission with a full pardon, wouldn't he be likely to return to service duly chastened and repentant?
Malthorn looked for a moment as though he were considering the offer.
No, Rutherford. This I will not do. The only commission I will offer Drake is the commission to dangle from the end of a rope. Is this understood?
Yes, sir. Rutherford's heart sank as he imagined Drake trying to rush Albion to free his parents, while Dreadnought and the bulk of the capital ships of the Royal Navy were lurking in the system. There was still a hope that he could secure Drake a pardon from the king himself, but now Rutherford had to concentrate on his main duty, saving Albion from the Hrum. In that case, I have another suggestion for improving leadership in the fleet. Rutherford avoided looking at Cates, who had been waiting so quietly that the Admiral may have forgotten she was present. But before Rutherford could continue, Malthorn touched his ear and cocked his head. A scowl creased his forehead.
"Well, put him on, then,"
he snapped at whoever was on the other end of the call. Captain Harbrake of Nimitz appeared on the big viewscreen above the bridge. Rutherford had just been thinking of the man and his ship. He was about to suggest that Malthorn put Cates at the helm of Nimitz and put Harbrake somewhere more suitable to his talents, or lack thereof. Harbrake's big hound-dog eyes seemed even more droopy than usual. His forehead was bandaged, and his arm was in a sling. The computer console behind the captain was a black, twisted piece of plastic and metal. There had apparently been a fire on his bridge.
"What the devil?" Malthorn demanded.
"They caught us unaware, sir."
"How did they manage that?"
Harbrake licked his lips.
"We came at the smuggler base, sir. The one that we caught scanning us. Calypso attacked from below, and I made a direct approach with Nimitz. But we didn't see the second base. They fired missiles and knocked through the fore shield."
"And where was your destroyer escort during all of this?"
"I didn't think I'd need them, sir. I sent them chasing a Ladino craft that made a run for it. They caught it, sir, but alas, they were out of position when the fighting started. Without adequate firepower, I was forced to withdraw from combat."
"Wait, you withdrew? You didn't even destroy the pirate base?"
"I am afraid not, sir."
Malthorn gaped. He sputtered for a moment, and then snarled for someone to cut the connection. It vanished, Harbrake's sorry visage replaced by a view of Nimitz and Calypso lying motionless a few dozen miles off port. Malthorn ordered the zoom brought in further. Nimitz scars were visible from a distance, with one of the rear engines leaking plasma. Black craters pitted Calypso's surface from stern to bow. Rutherford could scarcely believe Harbrake's stupidity. The man could have called ahead to soften the blow, but he'd been so craven, so afraid to face the Admiral's wrath, that he'd returned all the way to the fleet before giving the bad news, and now the magnitude of his failure was visible for all to see. The bridge was in an uproar as the Admiral leaned back in his chair and stared at the ceiling, shaking his head in disbelief and muttering curses. Rutherford would have been amused at this display of Harbrake's incompetence, but instead two of the most powerful ships in the Navy had been bloodied by a feisty snake pit of smugglers, illicit miners, and pirates. Calypso and Nimitz were older model aggressor-class cruisers, but they should have been more than enough to handle the mission. Now they were wounded and weakened in advance of the critical fight with the Hrum Death Fleet. Malthorn sprang up and slammed his hand down on the table. Rutherford and Cates scrambled to their feet. Malthorn jabbed a finger at Rutherford.
You will be my fire support. Vigilant and Churchill will do what those destroyers failed to do. I will take this battleship and clear these vermin out myself.
But, Admiral, we don't have time for pirates and smugglers, Rutherford said.
You would leave them unchallenged, allow them to attack our ships with impunity.
It will take us 12 days to reach Albion if we leave now. Returning to the pirate redoubt will burn 2 days at least, and we'll have no time to prepare for the Hrum.
You said as short as a fortnight, possibly longer.
An estimate, Admiral, listen to me.
No, we will launch a punitive expedition and crush them. Rutherford, you have your orders.
Malthorn turned, shouting for his officers to meet him in the war room. What had been a simple raid to stay agile while gathering the fleet had now become cause for a major punitive expedition, and that seemed to have burned all sense from Malthorn's thoughts. No wonder he had attacked the Drake estate so viciously. Malthorn's mind was fully occupied with thoughts of revenge.
"Lord Admiral!"
Rutherford called, but Malthorn stormed off without turning and disappeared into his war room. Rutherford muttered a low oath. Every minute spent on Dreadnought increased the delay until the fleet jumped to Albion, so he collected Lieutenant Cates, and the two of them left the bridge on their way to the away pods.
"So close," he said, as they got on the lift. "If I had spoken one moment earlier, it would have happened. Imagine if I'd told Malthorn that you deserved to be commanding officer of HMS Nimitz just before the viewscreen popped up with Harbrake's stupid, gaping expression. Nobody could have planned better timing. Now, when I make the suggestion, it will look like opportunism, and Malthorn will have cooled down and remembered all the political reasons he put Harbrake at the helm."
"It is all right, sir," Kate said. "There will be other opportunities. I do appreciate your efforts on my behalf."
Rutherford fixed her with a sharp look.
"This was not on your behalf, let us be clear about that. You are an obviously superior officer to Harbrake, and I wanted you at the helm of a capital ship before we go into battle, just in case there are misunderstandings about my motives."
"Why would there be?"
He put his hand on the button to keep the lift doors closed. "Because you are a woman and very young. And because you are..." He swallowed this down, uncomfortable saying it. "Because you are pretty, people will talk."
"That is ridiculous," she said. "I don't know if you're scoffing at being called pretty or complaining because of the implication of fraternization with your superior officer, but both of those things are true, and they are holding you back from your rightful place as captain of a Royal Navy cruiser."
"It won't hold me back for long."
Cates had hesitated when Rutherford first proposed the plan, claiming to be unready for such a promotion, but he saw no hesitation in her now, as she thrust out her chin and flared her nostrils.
"Well said, Lieutenant. It speaks to your good breeding."
He took his hand off the button and the doors opened. "Now let us get this ridiculous punitive expedition out of the way so we can go home and protect Albion from destruction." Something that he'd said, or what had happened on the Lord Admiral's deck, had set her thinking, and not in a good way, because Cates was fuming, muttering to herself, by the time they reached the away pods. She scarcely hesitated before climbing into the cylinder and strapping herself in with a loud click. Shortly, they were hurtling through space on their way back to Vigilant. Chapter 10. Drake blinked at the viewscreen. His thoughts were hazy, like he'd awakened from sleep, but he had no headache, and his mind was quickly recognizing the catastrophic scenario presenting itself. 6 Hroom sloops sat arrayed in what was known as a Hroom claw, but was more like a sideways bowl, with the mouth enveloping Dunkley's schooner, and all the Hroom pointed in toward it. Instruments showed Hroom serpentines warmed up, and pulse cannon began to thump at the schooner. Dunkley belatedly fired up his plasma engine and began to nose around to escape the claw, which was about to clamp down, and hard.
"Gunnery," Drake said into the comm. "Tubes 3 and 4.
"Barker?"
"Here, sir,"
came the man's groggy voice.
"Tubes 3 and 4.
"And belly cannon. Fire all guns on the lead sloop."
"Aye, sir."
Tolvern was alert now and giving instructions to engineering, while Smythe lifted from where he slumped over his console. He shook his head and groaned.
"Wake up, Smythe," Tolvern said. "I need those specs, and I need them now."
"Got it, Commander,"
he slurred, and began to fumble at his console. Cap was cursing and rubbing her temples, but Nib Pym was still staring around him with his big Hroom eyes, looking not so different from an addict at the end of a long sugar swoon. Sometimes the Hroom seemed to come out of the jumps more slowly than humans. Isabel Vargas came through the jump with Outlaw, but the shark-nosed frigate sat dead and motionless at the moment. Isabel's crew would be staggering about for some time before they could be useful. Meanwhile, the slow, natural movement of the jump point gradually moved her away from it, opening a position for the next ship in the fleet, which would be Paradis on another schooner, followed by Pussycat and her heavy armaments, and finally Katarina on Orient Tiger. Somehow, Drake had to hold the Hroom off until they arrived. All this passed through his head in a moment, even as pulse cannon fire slammed into the schooner. Dunkley's shields held, and he twisted away like a fish evading a spear gun. The first bomblets swarmed out from enemy serpentine batteries. In minutes, the entire bowl-like space between the sloops of war would be filled with them.
"Echelon formation," Drake said. "Break the claw."
This was directed to Tolvern. She had already opened a channel with Dunkley and gave orders. Meanwhile, Outlaw was coming about, and Isabel seemed to understand exactly what he intended. Her systems were still warming up. It would be a moment before she could join the fight, but she swung in to join him in the echelon. Soon they were arranged on the diagonal, ready to charge and hammer the Froom formation until it broke apart.
"Torpedoes ready," Barker said through the comm. "Fire."
A pair of torpedoes raced ahead of the ship, even as Blackbeard and Outlaw thrust forward, accelerating to puncture the back of the formation. Enemy sloops moved to evade. Blackbeard's belly cannon opened up with kinetic fire. The range was still too great, but the cannon fire forced additional evasive action. Paradis came through the jump. His schooner sat dead, but Blackbeard and Outlaw were now roaring into the fight to help Dunkley. All Dunkley had to do was straighten his bow and lead those torpedoes in clearing a path. Blackbeard and Outlaw would follow, and, in a massive wedge, would break the claw. But Dunkley didn't obey the commands Tolvern was shouting through to him. His schooner was agile and fleet of foot, and Dunkley seemed to think he could ignore orders and shake off the attack alone. Bomblets swirled around him, and, incredibly, he slipped between them and emerged from the bowl nearly unscathed, with Hroom warship still shooting after him. Dunkley attempted to circle behind the cruiser and the frigate, where he could be protected by their guns, or so Drake could only guess, as the fool was ignoring all orders from Blackbeard's deck. But by now the two ships were racing in tandem to puncture the back of the Hroom claw, and they blew past him. The end result was that Dunkley had eluded the closing claw, but he dangled, exposed. Paradis was still trying to get his own schooner moving, and the heavily armed Pussycat had just popped through and sat motionless. They were easy prey for the approaching Hroom warships. But the sloops ignored them and chased after Dunkley instead. One of the sloops trained her guns and pounded the rear of the schooner. She wriggled and squirmed, but a sloop flanked Dunkley on either side, with two more above and one below. Somehow Dunkley managed to get turned around and headed back toward the other human ships. Hroom guns filled the sky with flashing light. He took a vicious blow to his engines. The rear of the schooner flared, and a huge jet of plasma vented off into space. He kept going on sheer momentum, flying straight toward Blackbeard. One of the sloops darted in from the side. Its long, sharp nose stabbed into the side of the schooner. There was a flash of light, and a dozen secondary explosions as the schooner broke apart. The bridge of Dunkley's ship spiraled end over end until Hroom warships tore this largest piece of wreckage apart with pulse cannon fire. Katerina Vargas had come through. With the arrival of Orient Tiger, Drake now had three frigates and the remaining schooner to back him up. It was a formidable force even without Dunkley, but against six sloops, none of them injured, he'd be in trouble. He could handle a single sloop himself, maybe two or three with the other ships in support. If Rutherford had been with him at the helm of Vigilant, he'd have liked his odds. As it was, they looked grim. Having wiped out Dunkley's schooner, the enemy sloops were turning, fanning out to come at Blackbeard. The Royal Navy called this formation a throwing star, and Drake knew how to break that as well. If only he'd had more firepower to back him. Time for some improvising. Drake called his remaining ships.
"Pull back to the jump point. Guard the..."
"What do you..." Isabel's voice interrupted.
"Listen to me. Guard the jump point, as if we have a capital ship coming through that we need to protect. Katerina, move forward, as if you're going to spearhead another wedge."
They got it now and moved to obey. Perhaps chastened by Dunkley's demise, even Paradis and Aguilar obeyed without comment, and soon they were in a passable example of the throwing star breaking formation that Drake had been thinking of before. Or at least the first two-thirds of it. If he'd been able to add another cruiser or two, he'd be ready to face the Hroom.
"Debris," Jane warned. "Impact in 3 seconds."
A bit of Dunkley's wreckage spiraled across the viewscreen. They braced themselves, and the deck shuddered as the debris slammed into them.
"Thanks for the warning, Jane," Tolvern said sarcastically. Really helpful timing.
Warnings came through about shield damage from the hit, but Drake could tell from the strength of the impact and from how long it had taken Jane to identify the threat that it hadn't been serious. He kept his attention glued to the evolving position of the enemy fleet. The sloops pulled up when they were still 80,000 miles distant, and there they seemed to hesitate. A human commander surely would have known Drake was bluffing. With the possible exception of Blackbeard, these were obviously pirate ships and freebooters, not any official navy. Why should the Froom expect another cruiser to come through, and not a frigate, or nothing? They must suspect as much. But if this were really a suicide fleet, the Froom couldn't risk mixing it up and losing some of their firepower. A victory here would be as good as a loss unless they emerged unscathed. Drake was sure he could take out at least one of the sloops before they got him, and if he really had been counting on more ships to emerge from the jump point, the Froom would have left the encounter well bloodied. The sloops kept their formation, but turned in a wide arc, and flew away from Drake and the jump point. They came out of the formation to spread into a long line as they accelerated toward the inner system, and the several jump points through which they might escape. Drake let them go. The only thing to do was chart their exit from the system and pass this information along to Rutherford while he proceeded on his own course toward Albion. No word yet from his friend in the fleet, but Drake assumed that Rutherford was taking his warning seriously. Drake got the other captains on the view screen and chewed them out. This was why he was in command and the others subordinate at all times, why they were to obey his commands without question, whether they were in battle or not, why they should never interrupt or contradict when he was giving orders under fire, and why he would blow a hole in the next ship who defied him. If Dunkley had obeyed orders, he and his crew would still be alive. They listened, duly chastened, but Drake wasn't done.
"This is a military mission, and it will be treated as such. It is why I have paid for all this firepower, and why, if you think you know better than I do, you are undoubtedly wrong. I am a military commander, and none of you, for all of your skills, can say the same thing. In battle, my word is law, and so is Commander Tolvern's. If you hear it from the mouth of my commander, it is as good as if you heard it from my own. Is that clear?"
They said it was.
"Good. Stand by and await my orders."
He ended the call and settled into his chair, deflated. Numbers and memos flashed across his console as reports poured in from his ship and elsewhere in the fleet. They blurred past his vision. He could only think of the destroyed schooner. The image of it bursting apart was seared into his mind.
"A costly lesson, sir," Tolvern said, "but perhaps necessary."
"Perhaps."
"Let us hope," Nib Pim said, "that future lessons do not require the destruction of one of our warships and the death of 16 crew members on board."
Cap slumped in her chair and rubbed at her buzzed scalp.
"Dunkley, you are a bloody fool. You threw your life away, mate."
Cap had tried to pummel the man when they encountered him on Leopold, but she didn't sound like an enemy now. It was hard to see a silver lining in the literal cloud of debris left by Dunkley's obliterated ship, but one thing did occur to Drake.
"How much did I promise the sloop captains?"
3,000, sir. We'd already paid him 1,500 of it.
"Then I suppose that's 1,500 more pounds with which to bribe Katerina Vargas."
With Dunkley's death and the destruction of his schooner, Drake needed Orient Tiger more than ever. Chapter 11. The day after the brawl with the Death Fleet, the captain sent Tolvern and Cap to the lab, where Noah Brockett said he had something to share. Tolvern had nearly forgotten about the apex tissue samples given them by what she'd begun to think of as the friendly Room faction. Not that General Mose Driz wouldn't happily thrash Albion in battle if he could, but he wasn't trying to extirpate the human race from this sector either, not like the suicidal followers of the Room God of Death. Drake had seemed keen to personally follow up on Brockett's findings, but he'd finally heard from Rutherford, and Smythe had intercepted a mass of fleet communications, and these things demanded the captain's attention. Drake had also decided that the 6 sloops lurking outside the jump point had constituted a new death fleet, as there was no way the other one could have been in that exact spot at that time. That warranted additional thought, and he wanted to discuss it with Nib Pim,
who had a better knowledge of the jump points in the surrounding systems. So he sent Cap and Tulvern to see Brockett.
"I've been wondering something," Cap said, as the two women took the winding corridor that led to the labs. "Do you think this science bloke is good-looking?"
Tulvern had grown used to Cap's ribbing and learned that the best way to deal with it was to shrug it off. Still, with the former Marine always on her about being sweet on the captain, as Cap put it, this new angle was a fresh annoyance.
"No, not really. Anyway, I haven't thought of it much. I never see Brockett outside the lab."
"I didn't either, not at first. He's the giggy sort, and I ain't usually interested in them. Now he's in the books all the time, and he probably smells like them chemicals they use down there. You know that stuff they pump into dead bodies so they don't stink or nothing before you're done with them?"
"Formaldehyde?"
"Yeah." Tulvern stopped. They were almost to the lab.
"Wait, you're asking for yourself? Are you interested, Cap?"
Tulvern grinned. The other woman blushed and rubbed her arms where she'd rolled up her sleeves to show off the lion tattoo she was so proud of.
"I don't know. He looked like a ponce when we took him on."
"A ponce? You mean gay?"
"You know, not manly or nothing."
"Manly?" Tulvern smiled. "You're not an anti-intellectual, are you?"
"I ain't anti-nothing, and I know he ain't gay, 'cause I caught him checking me out in the mess the other day. You know the way blokes do when they fancy you? And that got me thinking, maybe he weren't so bad after all. And maybe he weren't a ponce neither."
"Brockett would be a big change from Carvalho," Tulvern said. Carvalho was almost a caricature of masculinity, with pirate swagger thrown in for good measure. Tulvern had stumbled into Cap's room once, while Carvalho was lounging on the bed, barely covered, and she'd had to drag her eyes away from his muscular body. He had a smug look that was both maddening and sexy, and he and Cap could scarcely keep their hands off each other.
"Yeah, he ain't happy with me at the moment."
"He's not?" Tulvern frowned.
"I'm sorry, did something happen?"
"You know, when we was in that pirate base collecting loot, there was this fellow, see, real handsome, Dutch bloke. I told him I'd shoot his stones off if he didn't show me where the treasure chest was, and he smirked at me like this." Cap made a face. "And he said he'd show me the treasure all right. Well, what was I to do? Carvalho was all busy looting, and it had been 3 days. I was ready for some. What was I supposed to do?" She sounded so earnest, but Tulvern couldn't help the laugh that burst out.
"Wait, so you're down there looting, and you somehow end up sleeping with one of the people we're supposed to be robbing?"
Cap looked glum.
"Yeah, and Carvalho stumbled through while we was groping each other. He didn't like that none. So now it has been a week since he's come to my room, and I didn't even get to finish with that Dutch bloke neither."
Brockett poked his head out the door of the science lab. "I thought I heard someone out here. Are you two coming in or what?"
"Course we are, love," Cap said. "Give us a sec, will you?"
Tulvern waited until Brockett had retreated to his lab.
"But when we were on Leopold, you told me Carvalho didn't care, so long as you, how did you put it, didn't run out of it."
"Yeah, but he ain't too keen on catching me in the act neither, know what I mean? He'll come around eventually, but now I'm wondering, what about Brockett?" Tulvern laughed.
"I won't tell you no."
"Unless you want him for yourself, I'll step out of the way and let you have him."
"No, not at all. Come on."
Brockett was staring into a microscope when they entered and didn't look up right away. His left hand fiddled with the diopter adjustment, while his right hand worked at a keypad where he was typing notes by touch. Tulvern and Cap glanced at each other, then seemed to come to an agreement by mutual consent to wait until he was finished, not wanting to interrupt him. Whatever it was, Brockett was very intense about it. He removed a slide and clamped down another, all without looking away from his equipment. At last he looked up from the microscope, rubbed the bridge of his nose, and grabbed for his glasses. When he'd put them on, he turned around and blinked.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Have you been there a while?"
"A few minutes," Tulvern said. "It looked important, so we thought we'd wait."
"What, this? No, I'm just looking at space barnacles."
"You're looking at space barnacles?" Tulvern asked. "What does this have to do with Apex?"
"Nothing whatsoever. It's a side project of mine. Did you know there are 11 known varieties of space barnacle? 9 of them are related, and they seem to have a shared genetic code with the star Leviathan. I think the same alien race must have created them both. Long ago. Millions of years, in fact."
"Wow,"
Cap said, with no trace of irony.
That's fascinating.
Tolvern cleared her throat.
About your message to the captain, but the other two species are from an unrelated lineage,
Rocket continued, as if neither of them had spoken.
They are purely organic, like the mollusks you might find in a planet-side ocean, except with adaptations for the void, of course. Where did they come from? How did they evolve for life in outer space?
Yes, anyway, Tolvern said impatiently, about your message to the captain. And here's another thing. Humans have only been in this sector for a few centuries, but there are already small adaptations for our ships, a subspecies of barnacle that seems to be evolving to survive around our plasma engines. In another few hundred years, they could be a real problem, clogging up our engines and requiring costly repairs.
Fancy that, Cap said.
She sounded utterly sincere, actually a little more than sincere, and she was articulating her words with extra care.
I'd love to hear more sometime.
I didn't know you were interested in genetics and biology, Brockett said.
It's rather a surprise to me, too, Tolvern said dryly.
Cap approached Brockett.
Can I look through your microscope? I want to see these space barnacles. They sound amazing.
Brockett pulled up a chair, and Cap found a way to touch his hand as he adjusted the microscope for her. She glanced back at Tolvern.
We ain't in no hurry, Tolvern. Give me a chance to have a look, will you?
Cap seemed terrible at this sort of flirting, and Tolvern didn't know why she bothered. The ensign was more the type to grab a semi-interested man and drag him into a broom closet before he had a chance to think of all the reasons why it might be a bad idea. But Brockett was eating up the attention. Soon, the pair of them were whispering bad puns about barnacles, giggling at supposedly witty things that one or the other said. Tolvern inspected the lab. It was a decent-sized room, maybe 80 square feet, with stations for three scientists, although they only had one dedicated officer. The Punisher-class cruisers had long-range capabilities and were built expecting that they would make deep space expeditions during times of peace, exploring unknown regions of space. The ship had been outfitted with an array of expensive equipment. Of course, the last war had started almost the moment HMS Ajax slipped out of the space yards of Yorktown, and within 2 weeks of taking their new commissions, Drake and Tolvern had found themselves in the thick of the first major naval engagement of the war. Because of this, Ajax had never had a science officer. Brockett was the first to use the lab, and by the time they'd brought him on board, the ship had changed names and its crew had turned to piracy. Brockett seemed tidy compared to others of his type, and the drawers were all closed, the jars in their secured holders on the shelves, neatly labeled. Charts hung from the refrigerator doors, with careful handwriting cataloging what could be found inside. Yet Brockett had an element of whimsy apparent in many of the signs around the lab. One fridge was labeled Stinky Stuff, and the other Nasty Stinky Stuff. Three gene splicers were labeled Maximus, Minimus, and Microscopius. A printed photograph of a woolly mammoth hung on the back side of the door, with Stumpy written in pen across the bottom. On closer inspection, Tolvern saw that the mammoth had an unusually short trunk. She'd seen mammoths at the zoo, and this one looked strange. Brockett looked up from his conversation with Cap.
My favorite professor was part of the team that recreated the mammoth. That was his first attempt. You can see they didn't quite get the trunk right.
Stumpy, Tolvern said.
I get it. The ears look funny, too.
There were sequencing errors in the bit we extrapolated from elephant DNA.
Wow, you did that? Cap said.
Not me, exactly, he said in a modest tone. Most of this was 20 years ago, before my time. Although I was involved in the cold weather tweaks, we used a snippet of muskox DNA.
You can take that DNA stuff from one kind of creature and put it in another?
Cap asked. She looked suddenly more serious, as if she'd just had a bright idea, and Tolvern edged over, ready for some genuine amusement. Brockett shrugged.
That's what I was doing on Hot Barsa, manipulating sugarcane genetics by studying the local flora. On Albion, I spliced the genes from one kind of fish into another to make it cold water hardy. That's what gave us the idea to try it with the mammoth.
That's all neat and stuff, but what about when them animals are more different? 'Cause I got a cool idea for when we discover a new planet, creatures I want to put on it and stuff.
How different? Brockett asked.
You know what platypuses are, right? Platypi, platyp... Whatever, you know?
Duck-billed platypuses, sure, from Old Earth, Australia. They didn't adapt well, so they're confined to a few reserves on Albion. I think there's a river on Mercia, too, but they're endangered everywhere.
That's exactly what I mean, Cap said. It's a bleeding shame. With them bills and beaver tails, I should be more common. I always wanted a pet one when I was a kid, keep it in the bathtub. But maybe if you crossed one with something a little more fiercer, it could defend itself.
Like what? Brockett asked.
I don't know, some water creature, but fiercer, you know.
Like a crocodile? He said, chuckling.
That's ridiculous, Cap said. That's a kind of lizard, and platypuses are mammals, everyone knows that. I was thinking a hippopotamus, say, with them big mouths and teeth.
Brockett brightened.
I like it. You do?
We could call it a hippoplatypus. Tolvern groaned. She could no longer keep her mouth shut.
Enough of the puns.
Technically, that's not a pun, Brockett said. That's a neologism. Anyway, don't tell me you wouldn't pay good money to see a hippoplatypus if one existed.
Maybe, Tolvern conceded.
Yeah, probably.
Hippoplatypus, Cap said. That's fun to say. Try it, Tolvern. Go ahead.
Hippoplatypus, Tolvern said. It was surprisingly satisfying, but the whole concept was nonsense.
Don't platypuses lay eggs? Are you telling me that this two-ton monstrosity is going to lay a bunch of eggs and sit on a nest?
Technically, Brockett began. Tolvern shook her head.
Did you call us down here to show us what you found with the apex tissue sample, or do you and Cap just need a chaperone?
Cap brayed laughter, while Brockett looked aghast. He sputtered and pulled a computer from his hip pocket. He brought something up, then closed it again.
I'm sorry, Commander Tolvern, please forgive me. It's just that I work in isolation, locked in here all day, and nobody much cares what I'm doing. So when Ensign Cap asked questions,
His voice trailed off. I guess I got carried away.
You're all right, both of you. I'm impatient and toward the end of my shift. If you had actually crossed a hippo with a duck-billed platypus, I'd be as keen to see it as the next person.
Tolvern nodded.
Show us what you found.
Brockett went to the fridge labeled Nasty Stinky Stuff and removed a large plastic container. When he popped off the lid, a disgusting smell, like bird feathers and rot, wafted out. He pinched his nose and hit a button on the wall. The circulation fans whirred louder, sucking the bad air out of the room. It helped a little. Brockett put on latex gloves and reached into the container. He pulled out a leathery, bird-like head fringed with feathers. The beak was open, and the thing's tongue dangled from one corner, stiff and black. The end of the head was a stump with dried blood and bone sticking out.
"This is it," Tolvern said. "I thought it was a tissue sample."
"What did you think I meant?"
"I don't know, a feather or something on a slide for your microscope?" "It's a bloody vulture, is what it is," Cap said. "Disgusting, put it away."
"I thought you wanted to see," Brockett said defensively. Tolvern dropped her hand from her mouth and nose.
"When I said show us, I meant tell us, actually. We don't need to look at the thing to smell it."
He lowered it back into the container.
"I have a second head if you..."
"No," both women said at the same time. "Okay, no worries." He sealed the head and put it back into the fridge, then peeled off his gloves and dropped them in the bin.
"But that's where things get interesting.
Let me show you a different way." He swiveled over a screen on an arm and brought up an image of two heads side by side. Why he couldn't have done that before was the first thought that came to Tolvern's mind. One of the heads was the one she'd just looked at, gray leathery skin stretched over a high bald dome with a fringe of drab feathers at the throat and ears. The second was covered with red feathers, had a less prominent forehead, and the beak was more curved. Tolvern leaned in for a closer look.
"Is one male and the other female?"
"Very good guess," Brockett said. "Terran bird species can be sexually differentiated when it comes to their plumage, and plenty of other species exhibit divergence by sex. That's what I assumed we had here, one of each gender of a highly differentiated species. But I managed to isolate their genetic structure a few days ago, a paired protein that behaves similarly to DNA. These two heads belong to different species."
"Which one is apex?" Tolvern asked.
"They both are, supposedly," he said. "The notes the room sent with the samples indicated they were taken from the wreckage of the same spacecraft.
There were several of the red-feathered specimens on board, but they only found this one grey one. Tolvern turned this over. And what does it mean?
I can only speculate. Maybe there were more of the grey variety in another section of the ship that didn't survive the battle. Could be that the red ones are slaves of the greys, or vice versa. Could be that Apex is an alliance of two closely related species, or the greys might be specialists, engineers or whatnot.
Tolvern considered. I suppose that if an alien race destroyed Blackbeard and salvaged the bridge, knowing nothing of either human or whom, they could have the same discussion. What is this tall, purple-skinned alien doing among all of these upright apes?
Yes, but these two species are from the same lineage, Brockett gestured at the bird-like heads on the screen. You can see it at a glance. Not like room and human. More like a chicken and a turkey.
They're not chickens and turkeys, they're apex predators, Tolvern reminded him. Tigers and lions would be more apt.
Cap leaned in and gave Tolvern a knowing look.
They got beaks and feathers. Chickens and turkeys, only fiercer.
There's one other strange thing, Brockett said. It may mean nothing, or it may be the key to the whole thing.
Go on, Tolvern said.
A sequential analysis of each specimen shows that both varieties of alien have been subject to heavy genetic manipulation. These two creatures are no more natural organisms than Stumpy the Mammoth.
That was disgusting, Cap said when they had left the lab.
You don't sound disgusted, you sound delighted, Tolvern said.
All that stuff about barnacles, that was the disgusting part. You were all over Brockett. I thought you were going to tear his clothes off.
I wanted to. If you hadn't been there, you bet I would have.
Cap punched the button to the lift. So how will you get Brockett back to your room without Carvalho seeing it?
Cap turned.
Huh? Before you went in, you asked if I thought Brockett was handsome. Apparently you have decided that he is. So I assume the next step is sneaking him into your room to have a go at him.
Nah, Cap said. No point to it now.
But you just said...
I mean, yeah, he is all right. That was fun talking to him and all. Bloke is kinda skinny, though, and don't seem to know what he's doing with women. Bet he's rubbish in the sack.
You never know until you try. Sometimes these geeky ones have it down to a science.
Cap grinned. Listen to you. Maybe it's you what should make a move.
She nudged Tolvern.
Go on, then, send him a note. Ask him to meet you in the mess for drinks.
While you smirk at me from the other side of the room? No thanks. Anyway, he smells like formaldehyde. If you don't like the way a fellow smells, the relationship won't go far.
That was the lab, not Brockett, Cap said. That smell washes off, you know. Could do it yourself with a nice long shower, lots of soap.
Cap snapped her fingers.
I got it. Figured out how to get Carvalho to come back around.
Tolvern laughed. Soap and water?
Yeah, he's working in hydraulics today, so he'll come out all greasy, and that earns him a double hot water credit. I'll catch him in the stall when he's naked.
But that reminded Tolvern of the awkward moment when she'd stumbled into the captain's bathroom thinking she'd seduce him, only to find out that Katerina Vargas had gotten there first. Tolvern was no longer interested in banter about the science officer or anyone else as they exited the lift. Instead, she was thinking about Apex, two different species. She didn't know what to make of it.
Chapter 12. Even while Drake was working with Nib Pym to plot their new course, he couldn't keep his mind off Rutherford's message. Something about it was eating at him, but he couldn't identify what while his pilot was going over numbers and charts. Jump points were always roaming around space, continually moving on a difficult-to-chart path. They could be more or less stable, with some lasting a few years, while others had been in place for centuries. Some might only last a few months. This was what Katerina Vargas had identified with her secret jump point into the unexplored Omega Cluster, where she'd confided to Drake that she intended to lead a fleet of colonists. The problem with Drake's approach to Albion was that he needed to hook into the system through one of a handful of jump points. The system was famously short of them, which is what rendered Albion so defensible, like the old Earth island of Britain itself, surrounded by a moat that had kept Hitler and Napoleon and all other invaders at bay from the days of William the Conqueror
until the great Anglosphere migration. Drake didn't face the same restrictions as the Hroom death fleets, as pirates had the run of these frontier systems when they could stay out of the way of the Royal Navy, but he couldn't simply waltz up to Albion without being challenged either. The safest jump point was currently on the opposite side of the sun from Albion, but that would mean a long haul toward the planet. Run the forts and rescue his parents from York Tower. Then join Rutherford in defending Albion against suicidal attacks from multiple Hroom fleets while avoiding Dreadnought and Admiral Malthorn. Simple, right?
Captain, did you hear what I asked?
Nib Pym said. He stared with his big liquid eyes. Drake looked down at the charts that the Hroom pilot had printed and spread across the table of the war room. He tried to rewind the conversation. Nib Pym had said something about the final approach before the Albion jump. Beyond that, he had nothing.
I'm sorry, pilot, my mind had wandered. Please repeat yourself.
I said there are two jump points that will take us close to the final approach, both in Phantalus. The first one will drop us 11 hours closer to the Albion jump, but it is also the course the Hroom fleets will most likely be taking.
In other words, we could find ourselves facing one of them again.
Yes, sir.
Drake didn't think the Hroom would be so close. By his calculations, he should arrive at Albion almost 3 days in advance of the first of the Hroom, and 2 days ahead of Rutherford, based on the most recent message from Vigilant. Changing course to avoid the Hroom fleet makes no sense. If they're that far ahead of our calculations, then we may as well turn around now, because we won't get to Albion in time. Either that, or we launch our own suicide mission to stop them before they jump.
So you want the shorter route, sir?
Is there an escape for Orient Tiger that direction?
Does Katerina Vargas still mean to abandon our fleet, sir?
I don't know, pilot, I don't know. But I won't trap her into joining us by leaving her no escape route either.
Yes, there are two other jumps nearby, either one of which would provide an adequate departure point for Orient Tiger.
In that case, yes, we'll take the shorter route.
Very good, sir.
After that, Nib Pym addressed minor issues, where Smythe had identified a rich patch of gas where they could use their ram scoops to collect hydrogen, the speed needed for the various jump points, and how that would impact fuel consumption. They needed enough juice to fight the battle and then blast out of Albion again when they'd finished. But these were perfunctory details appended to the briefing, and Drake reconsidered Rutherford's message while the pilot spoke. Rutherford's subspace, when it had finally come, contained a good deal of information, but concealed a good deal as well. Had Rutherford sent it with someone looking over his shoulder? Drake knew that most of Vigilant's crew were Malthorn loyalists, and Rutherford must have faced additional scrutiny as he joined the Admiral's fleet. Drake decided yes. Nib Pym asked permission to interface his nav chip with the nav computer to recalculate some dead reckoning numbers. While he did that, Drake pulled up Rutherford's message on his hand computer and reread it. Malthorn has ordered a punitive expedition against a pirate redoubt. I am to provide support fire. The expedition is expected to last no more than 48 hours. After, we will divide into two task forces and attempt to intercept the enemy invasion fleets. Estimated engagement with the Hroom in 1 fortnight. Captain Nigel Rutherford, HMS Vigilant. Drake finished with Nib Pym and dismissed him, then called Tolvern into the war room. She briefly shared what she'd learned from the science officer about the Apex tissue specimens. It was interesting, but less critical than other more pressing matters. He showed her Rutherford's message.
"What do you make of this?" he asked.
"Invasion fleets?" she said. "Plural. You told him about our fight?"
"No, not yet. I didn't have his location to send a subspace."
"So he must be aware of the second fleet some other way. How? Had those Hroom tangled with the Navy already?"
"Maybe," Drake said. "Or maybe there's a third force. Maybe this death cult divided their forces several times to be sure that one of them would get through."
Tolvern reread the message. A frown deepened on her face.
"It's thin on details. Not much else to it, is there?"
"Are you sure? Read it one more time."
She shrugged.
"All right."
"I'm not trying to test you," he assured her. "I am seeing something here, but I don't want to plant ideas that might be erroneous.
I would like to see if you independently come to the same conclusions.
Rutherford must still be in Griffin Shoals, Tolvern said, after a moment of deliberation. 12 days, plus 2 for an expedition against pirates, means he's probably on the far side of the system needs to cross once he's finished, then jump to Albion.
Good, Drake said. That was my thinking too, go on.
There's something else?
Rutherford says Vigilant is only providing fire support for the expedition.
Why would he do that?
It's not Rutherford's style at all. You know he wouldn't put Harbrake or Linzel at the vanguard. Could be that Vigilant got in another fight since we saw her and isn't battle-worthy.
But I don't think that's it. Because the Lord Admiral wants to lead the expedition himself, she said.
To which Drake nodded his agreement.
Which means that Dreadnought is leading the charge. That would also explain why the fleet was split in two upon its return to Albion. With that many capital ships, they have the firepower to fight 2 major battles at once.
Yes, exactly, Drake said. And if Admiral Malthorn is flag officer, it explains why they'd waste time on this punitive expedition. Who cares about pirates and smugglers? They can be dealt with at any time, or never for that matter. The Froom, on the other hand, threaten us with annihilation. Malthorn must have got his nose bloodied, and now he wants revenge. Like what he did to my parents' estate after Hot Barsa.
Or it could be Rutherford's idea, sir. A way to buy us a couple of days before the fleet arrives. Goad the Admiral into a side fight, so we have a chance to slip in and free your parents before the battle with the Froom.
Drake hadn't thought of that possibility. It was an intriguing idea, but it seemed too devious, too risky for Rutherford. The man was aggressive in battle and not above making a gambit against an enemy, but risking the whole of Albion to give Drake a chance to escape. No, that was not in Rutherford's nature. His nature was to sacrifice everything for the sake of expediency. He'd been that way as long as Drake had known him, which went all the way back to their friendship at the Naval Academy. In fact, there was one particular incident at the Academy that seemed an excellent guide for Rutherford's behavior now. The Academy was located in Juneau, on the coastal range abutting the North Sea, the continent of Canada, distant and isolated. The winters were long and hard, and it was far from the intrigues of Yorktown or the soft living of the country estates. The primary sports were skiing and hockey in the winter and rowing on Juneau Fjord after the ice melted in summer. Adventurous sorts took to hunting big game in the vast northern wilderness, which was right on Juno's doorstep. At the time, Drake had preferred more civilized prey, grouse, rabbit, duck, and wild turkey. Animals to hunt with a hound and a fowling piece. Hunt in the day and sup on your game that same evening. Rutherford, on the other hand, preferred the dangerous beasts, brown bears, snow leopards, and wolves. Especially wolves, the big, hungry brutes that had been living unchecked and unchallenged since the settlement 600 years earlier. One summer, during a week of leave, Rutherford talked Drake into joining him on a wolf hunt, armed only with bows and several cans of bear spray. They rode horses along a rough logging road, accompanied by Rutherford's big wolfhound, who loped next to them. The two men were very young at the time. Drake was 21, and Rutherford only 20, but they set off with supreme confidence. Their fathers were barons, and they were of good breeding and education. As future officers of the Royal Navy, they would soon be fighting Froom and pirates on the frontier systems. Surely they had nothing to fear from the unsettled Albion wilderness. On the second day, Rutherford spotted wolf spoor and tracks along the banks of a shallow, muddy river, and decided it was a good place to make camp. He shot a caribou, and the two men dragged it to the riverbank, then returned to their camp on the opposite bank, where they watched the other side through binoculars. The plan was to wait until the carcass attracted a pack of wolves, then cross with the dog and horses and shoot the biggest wolf they could find. Drake wasn't much one for trophy hunting, but Rutherford insisted that hunting wolves with bows would be sporting. Certainly more so than picking them off through the scope of a high-powered rifle, Drake agreed. They waited all day, emerging from their blind only to feed the horses and let the wolfhound stretch his legs. The dog was a big gray animal named Oxnard that Rutherford had bought 2 years ago in Juneau when he was only a pup, and Rutherford was freshly arrived from the islands.
Oxnard had a missing chunk in his right ear from a tussle with a snow leopard the previous fall, and Rutherford insisted he was fearless against wild animals. But he seemed a big dopey goof to Drake. It was hard to imagine him brawling with wolves. The wolves arrived near dusk. First a pair of smaller black ones, and then three larger gray wolves. Drake asked if they would set out right away to get the hunt over with. He was tired of the waiting and the relentless mosquitoes, and had been thinking all day how he'd rather have been hunting rabbits, or even risking bears to venture downstream and fish the larger river they'd forded the previous day. Then he'd be eating fresh game or fish right now, instead of cold food from a can. The devil take Rutherford's wolf hunt. Rutherford lowered his binoculars. The Alpha hasn't arrived yet, that's the one I want.
How can you tell? Drake took the binoculars. They all look pretty big to me.
You'll spot him by how the others react when he's around.
It was soon dark, and the possibility of hunting wolves ended, for the day at least.
No matter, Rutherford insisted, the wolves would be lurking around the caribou carcass for days, eating, fighting, and breeding, until they'd eaten it all. The longer the wolves remained, the more complacent they'd be when the two men crossed the river, and the less likely to attack out of hunger. Fat, complacent wolves. Where was the sport in that, Drake wondered. The young men sprayed down the horses against bugs and secured them in a makeshift pen between two boulders, with a gate of lashed-together branches sawed from a nearby copse of spruce. Then they retreated to their tent behind good mosquito netting. It smelled of wet wolfhound inside. Oxnard seemed unperturbed by the howling wolves on the other side of the river and was soon snoring and farting in his sleep. Drake didn't think he'd ever be able to fall asleep, and if the howling, snoring, and farting weren't enough, a high-pitched whine warned him that at least one mosquito had found its way inside. He buried himself in his bag to wait out the aerial assault, and soon found the toils of the long day carrying him off to sleep. Oxnard's low, rumbling growl brought him to consciousness. The dog was next to him in the tent, his head by Drake's ear. Drake groped for the dog and pushed his slobbery mouth to clear it away. Oxnard kept growling.
"Come on, you big oaf, move over there."
"What's the matter?" Rutherford asked groggily from the darkness.
"Your dog is growling in my ear."
A quick movement from Rutherford's side of the tent. Silence. Then a low curse. Oxnard moved closer to the zipped tent door, and Drake could hear the wolves again. They filled the air with ghostly howls. From across the river to the east came snarls and fighting. From downriver to the south, two wolves howling. A growl from nearer to camp, what sounded like this side of the river. One of the horses let out a frightened whinny. A third wolf howled from the south, the sound mixing with more snarls and fighting from that direction. Drake didn't know much about wolves, but that was either a huge wolf pack, or there was more than one pack out there. He joined Rutherford in groping in the darkness for his pants and boots, even while the wolfhound paced the tent as if anxious to get outside.
"Where's the lamp?" Drake asked.
"I don't know, I might have left it with the saddlebags." But then Drake's groping fingers found it, next to the tent flap, and he turned it on. A cool LED light illuminated the interior of the tent. They got dressed quickly and slid out through the partially open tent flap, the lamp in Drake's left hand, a can of bear spray in the right. Oxnard tried to muscle his way past them to get outside.
"No,"
Rutherford said sharply. He shoved the dog's nose back into the tent and zipped the flap. It was a clear night with a vast swath of stars overhead. The planet Thor had just risen above the mountains, a glittering emerald of light. Framing it was the constellation of the Great Celtic Cross, with Orion to the southwest, the most famous of the so-called Terran constellations, those old Earth formations of stars, known by the Greeks and Romans, and still visible from Albion. The crescent moon hung above the eastern horizon, a cool yellow glow, and the northern horizon glowed with streaks of blue and green from the aurora borealis. Drake had grown up on a small estate on a small civilized island. He'd always known the universe was vast, but now he felt it. That impression began with the huge continent of Canada, itself only one part of this as yet underpopulated planet. He felt the empty miles of surrounding plains sitting beneath a vast bowl of stars, themselves only a tiny part of the known universe, which stretched endlessly in all directions. Albion was hurtling around the sun, and the sun was rotating around the outer edge of the Milky Way. The beauty of the night sky almost took his breath away. But then the howls started again to his right and left, and the hairs stood up on his arms and the back of his neck. A low shape slunk by on his left, and he whirled. Rutherford cursed, and Drake turned to see another wolf staring at them from that direction, tongue lolling. Drake picked up a stone and pitched it at the wolf, and the animal retreated into the darkness.
"Why aren't they eating the caribou?" Drake asked. "What do they want with us when there's all that meat over there?"
"The first pack must be defending it against this one. They can't get to the carcass, but they've smelled us and our animals."
Oxnard whined from inside.
"Let him out," Drake urged.
"He will attack the wolves if he gets out," Rutherford said. "And there are too many of them. It will be the end of him."
"We can't just sit here doing nothing.
We need the bows, that will even the odds."
"Bows?"
It was one thing to hunt wolves by daylight, stalking them, shooting them from a distance on the back of a horse, but another thing entirely to attempt it at night.
"Any better ideas?" Rutherford asked.
"No, I guess not. All right, then, on my mark."
Drake checked to make sure the path was clear.
"Go!"
The two men broke for the saddlebags. Drake put down the lantern when they arrived, and he and Rutherford groped for their bows. Drake still had the can of bear spray from the tent, and now grabbed a second from his saddlebag and shoved it into Rutherford's hands. A snarling shape launched itself from the shadows, and Drake dropped his bow and aimed the bear spray. The can hissed as it launched the peppery liquid. He gave the wolf a snootful of it, blasting until the animal fell back, snarling and howling. Another wolf came at Drake, and he hit this one, too. Rutherford fired an arrow, and a wolf yowled in pain.
"Got you," Rutherford said.
He notched another arrow. This time he missed, cursing his bad aim. Drake didn't have time to watch Rutherford. He was too busy with the bear spray. He hit a third wolf, then a fourth, but the can was already sputtering and spuming. Rutherford tossed him the other can. He turned on the nozzle just in time to hit a huge wolf in the mouth and eyes. Rutherford had shot at least one of them with an arrow, and Drake had now blasted five different wolves with the bear spray. The whole pack should have been retreating in disarray and confusion. Instead, they circled the two men, snarling, fainting, staying moving, and hidden in the darkness. The horses behind the two men snorted and stamped in their protective enclave. A horse darted forward, and Drake expended more bear spray, driving it off.
"We've got to get out of here," he said. "We're almost out of spray."
"What about the horse paddock?" Rutherford asked. "Get inside, shut the gate, and wait it out. What's to keep them from climbing the rocks and jumping down on us?" "You're right, damn it."
Rutherford's voice was tight and nervous, which in turn filled Drake with alarm.
"Can you ride bareback?" Drake asked. "We'll make a run for it. God knows there's enough light to see."
"And leave all our gear?" Rutherford said. "We've got to get out of here. We'll be killed if we don't."
There were more wolves than ever, what seemed like 15, 20 of them, moving, snarling, and howling in the shadows.
"They'll chase us," Rutherford said. "The horses will panic and throw us off in the darkness. We need a diversion. Cover me."
Before Drake could contemplate what Rutherford meant by this, the man had thrown down his bow and was racing back toward the tent. Drake ran after him. A wolf sprang out of the darkness, and he gave it a taste of bear spray. It fell back, snarling. Rutherford unzipped the tent. Oxnard burst out with a roar. Another wolf had come slinking in from the right, and Drake turned to see it crouching to spring at him. But the wolfhound slammed into it and drove it to the ground, his huge jaws clamping on the wolf's throat. Other wolves poured out of the darkness to attack the dog. Rutherford made a run for it, and Drake followed. A wolf attacked them while they were opening the paddock, and Drake used the last of the bear spray on it. Another wolf jumped for him as he scrambled onto the panicky horse's back, but he kicked its ribs and sent it flying. Most of the pack was fighting Oxnard, who was still baying and snarling.
Rutherford and Drake rode toward the fighting dog and wolves and scattered them as they made for the caribou trail they'd followed to get into the river valley. Drake looked back, hoping to see Oxnard shake off the wolves and run after them, but the dog couldn't get free of the pack. Rutherford rode relentlessly forward through the night, trying to put distance between them and their attackers, and Drake had no choice but to follow. Behind them, the wolfhound kept fighting until the men had ridden out of earshot. Dawn found the two young men cold, hungry, and sore several miles along the road back toward Juno. Drake mentioned the dog, a comment he meant to be sympathetic, how Oxnard had died defending them, but Rutherford told him to shut up, he didn't want to talk about it. Anyway, it was done. It was obvious that Rutherford was upset to have lost his wolfhound, but he seemed to have no question in his mind that the sacrifice had been necessary and expedient. Now, years later, and facing both the orbital forts and the Hroom death fleets, Drake was aware that he might have to fight Malthorn, too. Rutherford needed to stop the Hroom, and it didn't matter if it left Drake and his ship exposed to the guns of HMS Dreadnought. "You are the Wolfhound. Rutherford is going to sacrifice you to save Albion." Chapter 13. The assault on the pirate settlements of the Griffin Shoals proceeded as soon as Rutherford was back at the helm of Vigilant. The bulk of the Admiral's fleet, barring Nimitz, Calypso, and a handful of destroyers and corvettes to protect the damaged cruisers, raced toward the innermost of the system's three asteroid belts. Rutherford led Vigilant, Churchill, and nine destroyers in setting a blockade around the asteroid cluster protecting the pirates. Malthorn approached at the helm of Dreadnought and laid down a punishing fire on the main port and colony. When the pirates tried the same trick that had damaged Nimitz and Calypso, Rutherford's forces swooped in and blasted the rear fortifications to rubble. Three pirate frigates appeared and attempted to break the siege, but HMS Lancelot, a corvette, held them at bay until she could be supported by a pair of nearby missile frigates. Lancelot sustained several hits, but destroyed one of the enemy ships and drove the other two into Rutherford's destroyer screen, where they were shortly finished off. Soon, ships were fleeing the pirate redoubt like rats from a sinking ship. Navy torpedo boats obliterated a frigate and two schooners, while Vigilant came alongside a pair of merchant galleons making a run for it. They immediately tried to negotiate, offering up holds stuffed with bullion and loot as payment. Rutherford ignored the request. Now the galleons tried to surrender unconditionally. Rutherford didn't have time to take prisoners and called the Admiral for instructions. Destroy them. Rutherford took on the faster of the two galleons first. He needed to preserve his long-range arsenal for the fight against the Hroom, so he pulled along starboard and presented his cannon. The first broadside left the galleon crippled and venting gases. The second blew her apart. The slower galleon sent off escape pods, but Rutherford ignored these and focused on the ship herself. The galleon held Vigilant at bay for nearly an hour, with a powerful deck gun and two rear torpedo tubes, but as soon as she seemed to exhaust her defenses, Vigilant swooped in, took out her engines, and then circled back around to punish her with cannon fire. The first broadside ignited ammunition stores on the quarterdeck, and a terrific blast tore the galleon in two. One piece spun away end over end, while the other drifted a few hundred miles and then detonated in a final explosion. Vigilant returned to the fleet to find Dreadnought silencing her guns, the pirate operation demolished. Rutherford gathered the rest of the fleet and withdrew cautiously, alert for counterattack, until they were safely clear of the asteroid belt and in open space again. The entire operation was textbook for how to deal with rebellious elements on the frontier. This untidy nest of piracy and smuggling had been a thorn in Albion's side for years, taking advantage of the Hroom wars to prey on shipping, harass legitimate mining operations, and raid refueling and resupply stations. York Company shipping had been taking costly detours through the fringes of the shoals to avoid it, which had added nearly 3 days to their voyage every time they traversed the system.
Now the main pirate base was routed, its fortress obliterated, its spaceport in ruins, and some 20 pirate ships destroyed. Explosions continued deep underground on the hollowed-out asteroid as they departed. This victory came at the cost of one lost torpedo boat, minor damage to two destroyers, and a total of 11 lives lost. Malthorn's communication to the fleet was jubilant, boastful, promising a return expedition in the near future to finish the job against the other pirate outfits in the system. If not for more pressing business, the Admiral said, they'd do it now. Another few weeks and the Griffin Shoals would be cleaned up for good. Unfortunately, by the time they made it back to where the rest of the task force waited, performing emergency repairs on Nimitz and Calypso to get them battle-ready, 43 hours had passed since Malthorn's tantrum. That was nearly 2 days that could have been spent racing toward Albion to establish a defensive cordon against the Hroom assault. A few hours later, Rutherford left Pittsfield at the helm and retreated to his quarters. He had only slept 14 hours in the past 3 days and desperately needed rest, but he was angry, furious even. He got up and paced the room. 43 hours, he muttered. Wasted, thrown away. He punched up the view screen above his entertainment nook and looked at the long, empty space until the jump point that would take them to Albion. From Vigilant at the Vanguard to Dreadnought and her screen of destroyers in the rear, the fleet stretched 11 million miles, but as Rutherford drew the map out to the scale needed to see the entire distance they needed to traverse, those 11 million miles could not be differentiated from a single point on the map, a pinprick in space. The fleet was on the wrong side of the sun and had to reach the far outer fringes of the system, a few billion miles away. They'd be 43 hours closer if Malthorn hadn't insisted on this revenge mission. Meanwhile, suicidal alien forces were converging on Albion. Damn Malthorn. Damn stubborn, vainglorious Lord Malthorn. But Rutherford's rage couldn't burn forever, and soon enough he found himself crawling into bed, the lights out, as exhaustion took hold. He fell asleep and dreamed that Malthorn was king. In the dream, Rutherford was at the coronation ceremony in the royal palace at Yorktown, while the Admiral smugly approached the Archbishop of York, who held aloft the crown. Rutherford stood next to Drake in a long line of fleet officers in red and black. He was trying to tell Drake that this wasn't right, that the Admiral was only the king's cousin, only sixth in line for the throne. Together they had to stop Malthorn before the Archbishop placed the crown on his head. Rutherford woke with the sense that something was wrong. The smooth hum of the ship through the walls and floor was unchanged. There were no warning lights, and nobody had awakened him. He checked the clock, but it had only been 9 hours. A long, long sleep by his standards. He had showered and was drinking his coffee before he recognized what was off. Pittsfield's early shift memo was missing. It was normally a green blinking light on Rutherford's handheld computer, greeting him the moment he awakened. Pittsfield always sent a brief, bullet-pointed status report for Rutherford to read while he drank another scalding cup of coffee. Where was it? Rutherford came warily onto the bridge, convinced that his commander would be gone, and possibly Catherine Cates, too. In their place, more Malthorn loyalists. More incompetent loyalists. But both officers were there. Pittsfield sprang from the captain's seat and stepped aside to let Rutherford take his place. The commander's lips were pressed tightly together in the way that indicated worry. Rutherford frowned as he sat down, still wondering what was wrong.
What happened to my memo?
Apologies, sir. The situation could not be easily summarized, and as there is no urgency, I thought it best to explain to in person.
Well then, Rutherford said impatiently. Explain it already.
He glanced up as he said this and noticed the view screen for the first time. A long, spear-nosed Hroom sloop of war filled it. Rutherford jumped to his feet.
What is this?
Pittsfield quickly filled him in on the developments of the past 9 hours. The fleet had been hauling across the system at close to maximum speeds,
Admiral Malthorn had apparently repented of his unnecessary attack on the pirates and decided that they should arrive at Albion as soon as possible, even if that meant leaving some of the slower ships behind. So he'd ordered the swifter cruisers to lead Dreadnought to the jump point, while allowing the destroyers' corvettes and support craft to form a second flotilla that would jump through a few days after the initial force. Under other circumstances, Rutherford would have argued to maintain the proper fleet arrangement, with destroyer screens protecting the larger capital ships. But it was hard to imagine an enemy fleet strong enough to challenge Dreadnought and six cruisers, even with Calypso and Nimitz damaged. The second force had 18 destroyers and corvettes and 33 frigates and torpedo boats. Surely either force could defend themselves long enough for reinforcements to arrive. Rutherford agreed with the decision. Get Dreadnought and the cruisers into the home system. Defeat the Hroom if possible, but otherwise hold them off until the rest of the Royal Navy warships arrived. Unbeknownst to Malthorn, Rutherford, or anyone else in the fleet, there had been another force traveling through the Griffin Shoals. They were well cloaked and nearly on the edge of the system, passing through the outermost of the three asteroid belts, where they would be especially hard to detect. If there hadn't been such a large naval force, the enemy might have made it through undetected. But Malthorn had so many ships looking in every direction for threats that it was almost inevitable that one tech officer noted an anomaly in a long-range scan, and then the hunt was on. Soon they had identified six sloops of war. It was the same size as the other known Hroom fleets, but given its location, this had to be a different force. How many fleets were there? Several, apparently. Even combined, the Hroom ships wouldn't be powerful enough to defeat the Royal Navy, but they didn't have to be. Send enough, each sneaking into the Albion system via a different route, and it would be impossible to intercept them all. Get one fleet past, any fleet, and they could fly into the atmosphere on their one-way mission to vaporize Albion with atomic weapons. Rutherford looked at the warship on the screen, which shimmered oddly, a composite image of long-range scans from numerous ships. Together they gave a fairly accurate representation. "Has anyone tried to hail the Hroom?" Rutherford asked.
"Not that I'm aware of, sir, but there doesn't seem to be much ambiguity to their intentions. Norris, show him."
The Hroom warship vanished, and the viewscreen showed a schematic of the system, with its rocky inner worlds and three vast asteroid belts, the so-called shoals being so difficult to navigate, stretching all the way to an outer ring of icy comets. A line curved from the Hroom fleet toward the same jump point the Navy meant to take.
"They're going straight to Albion, sir," Pitsfield said.
"Will they beat us to the jump point?"
"Yes and no,"
Pitsfield explained. At the Hroom's current course and speed, the enemy would arrive at the jump midway between Dreadnought's arrival and the destroyer and corvette-led second wave. Dreadnought and the cruisers would arrive first, could prevent the Hroom from leaving the shoals. Rutherford called the flagship and suggested to the Admiral that they hail the Hroom, warn them they'd been detected, force the Hroom to seek another route to Albion. That would buy time to get the whole fleet home before they were forced to fight. Malthorn said no, they would intercept the Hroom at the earliest possible moment and destroy them. That meant fighting here in the Griffin Shoals. When the call ended, Rutherford could no longer contain his anger and cursed the Lord Admiral for his idiocy. Norris and Swayze, Malthorn loyalists, were watching Rutherford carefully, but he didn't care.
"Sir," Pitsfield warned, his tone nervous, "have you eaten yet? Perhaps if you..."
He stopped and said to the rest of the bridge, as if explaining,
"The captain just woke up, and the situation caught him by surprise. Sir, perhaps if you had breakfast, drank some coffee, met with us in the war room..."
"Rubbish!" Rutherford cut in. "I don't need coffee, and I am not hungry either. By God, I'm furious! Malthorn's plan is beyond asinine. We will be here fighting over a bunch of asteroids, while half a dozen death fleets incinerate Albion."
"Sir," Pitsfield said quietly,
"we have no choice in the matter."
The other man's voice was so calm and reasonable that it deflated Rutherford's anger. He had stomped away from his chair during his rant, but now he stopped
and looked at his commander for a long moment, and realized that Pitsfield was right. Certainly Rutherford could break from the fleet and make a run for it, mutiny like Drake had, go through the jump point and join whatever defenses remained in the home system. But alone, what good would he do? He may, however, assist Dreadnought and the other cruisers in crushing this particular enemy force as quickly as possible. The faster they ended the battle, the faster he'd be able to get them through to the other side. Meanwhile, Norris and Swayze were staring, alarmed. Rutherford could only imagine the private communications they would send to the Lord Admiral. After what had happened on HMS Ajax, there was no question that Rutherford would be removed from command the moment it looked as though he might go rogue. For that matter, Cates looked aggravated too, and he could see the conflicted loyalty in her face. Pitsfield's too. Neither of them wanted this fight. Rutherford formed an apology, though the words tasted like ash in his mouth. The commander is correct. I misspoke in my eagerness to defend Albion. We will follow the Lord Admiral and obliterate these enemies first. Pitsfield let out a long, relieved sigh. Cates, Norris, and Swayze turned back to their consoles. My God, Rutherford thought, as his emotions settled. I almost did it. I almost mutinied against the fleet. Chapter 14. Drake called the pirate captains to meet with him on Blackbeard before the final jump into the Albion system. He brought over Katerina first, greeting her personally in the engineering bay when she stepped out of her away pod. She stretched, yawned, and glanced at the crew moving torpedoes with forklifts and hauling belts of 10-inch projectiles for the deck gun. Other men and women stayed busy making minor repairs to equipment damaged in the fight with the pirate fortress, and the smell of ozone from arc welders and the hiss of blowtorches filled the engineering bay. Anything that could be brought into the engineering bay instead of repaired in space could be found here. Carvalho walked past, his face streaked with grease, while Barker drove a forklift with a damaged belly gun. That wasn't a good sign. That gun should be installed and ready to go, not dismounted so close to the jump. Several techs jumped into action as soon as Barker lowered the gun to the floor. So organized, Katerina said as she joined Drake in crossing the bay toward the lift. Half of my people would be smoking, playing cards, or getting drunk behind a pallet of crates. We will be facing professional soldiers, Drake said. I don't want to go into battle leading a bunch of undisciplined amateurs. Where are the other captains? They'll be here in an hour. I wanted to see you first. Katerina raised an eyebrow. Looking to seduce me? Or are you finally making a final attempt to coerce me into joining your fleet? Or maybe you'll try the first thing to make the second thing happen. Believe me, if I thought seducing you would help, I would do it. Her eyes flashed. What about doing it for pleasure? Does there have to be an ulterior motive? Drake lifted his hands. Please, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it like that. It's just... I'm worried about my parents, about the Hrum, about facing Dreadnought. There is too much pressure to think of anything else. I understand. You are a man of duty. That is why I want you for my own fleet. Your colonization scheme? How's it coming? You know the haul we took from the Tyrillium barge, Katerina said. I've spent every guinea, plus some. That was a lot of gold. I hope you got your money's worth. I hope so, too. I'm mostly stockpiling gear at this point. Lorries, fuel, a couple of mini-nuclear reactors, transport ships with stasis chambers. Plus there's equipment for refining ore, manufacturing chemicals, everything from plastics to pharmaceuticals. It's a one-way trip. I don't want to get into the Omega Cluster, watch the jump point collapse behind me, and then realize I forgot my toothbrush. Drake laughed. I still need ships, Katerina continued. And I need good men and women to lead them. The colonists themselves can wait until the last moment. I don't want Albion or anyone else to get wind of my plan until it's too late to stop. They'd come onto the lift, and now they entered the bridge. Tolvern frowned after them,
as Drake and Katerina made their way across to the war room. Once inside, Katerina grabbed the chair at the head of the table, leaned back, and propped her boots up. An insouciant grin stretched across her face as she studied him.
"No boots on the table?" she said. "I don't see a sign."
Drake sighed and sat down opposite her. "What will it take to keep Orient Tiger in the fight?"
"If you want my ship and crew, you can have it. 12,000 now, 12,000 when we finish. £24,000.
"You know I don't have it."
"How much do you have?"
"About 5."
"That's what I figured," she said. "Not enough."
"There's treasure in York Tower, bullion for the mint. Could be a haul for the ages."
"Could be, sure. And gold doubloons might start spewing out of your engines, too."
"How about this? I will promise you the next sum of money that comes into my hands, whenever that happens."
"An IOU?" she said suspiciously. "Is that what you mean?"
"More or less. For now, I'll give you the money I won't have to pay Dunkley since he got himself killed. A down payment. After that, you can have the next £25,000 that comes into my hands."
A calculating look crossed Katerina's face. "If I weigh the odds that you don't survive this mission, that I don't survive it, plus the likelihood that you wouldn't be able to deliver because I am pressed for time or you are unable to keep your crew aship, all the possible ways this scheme can fail, then I would say that 25,000 paid in the future looks more like £50,000.
"50?" he said, disbelieving. "You want £50,000 to rent the services of your pirate frigate? At those prices, what is Blackbeard worth, 100? He laughed. "Maybe Malthorn would rent me Dreadnought for 1,000,000 guineas. Is that a good price?"
Katerina sprang to her feet, glaring. "I'm giving you a bargain you don't deserve. You already lost one ship. And I'd wager Orient Tiger at 2-to-1 odds that you'll lose at least one more ship before you come out the other side. Hell, at 5-to-1 I'd wager that you lose your whole blasted fleet. But instead, I'm offering you my services at £50,000, backed only by your wishful thinking and my misguided sentiment."
"Misguided sentiment, oh sure, you care so much that you will only charge £50,000. How generous of you."
"If you're going to insult me, I won't stay another moment."
"Fine," he spat. "You can have your 50,000. Once we're done, I'll go steal some money for you."
"And what will you pledge in collateral to assure your debt?"
"So now you want collateral. Of course you do." Drake couldn't keep the bitterness out of his voice. "I am so pleased that my parents' lives depend on your mercenary whims."
"Go to hell."
Katerina stormed toward the door. Drake caught her wrist, and she spun on him. Her other fist cocked as if she would crush him one on the nose. He let go and stepped back, blinking. For a moment she stood staring at him, her nostrils flaring, fury on her face. He said nothing until she began to calm. It gave him a chance to reconsider. "I am sorry," he said, and meant it. "You are right. Please forgive me."
"That is the second time you've apologized. I will accept the apology, but this is the last time. Do you understand that, James?"
"Yes."
Katerina sat back down. "Very good. Now that you're willing to be reasonable, you may go on."
"I do not have the money to pay you what you're worth. And you are right, future promises are worth little. What I want to know is if there is anything I can do, say or promise, that will keep Orient Tiger in the fleet."
Katerina was quiet for a long moment, as if seriously considering this. "I have never met your parents. I have no loyalty to Albion. You understand I'm not callous or indifferent, but this is my starting point. You hired my services as a professional, and you have offered me nothing to make it personal. Since that hasn't happened, the only thing we can do is treat this as a professional transaction."
"You are right, of course. I shouldn't have made it personal."
Still, Drake found himself disappointed. He'd half expected her to ask that he commit to her colonization scheme as the price for her cooperation, join her in piracy to raise the necessary funds to build her fleet of pioneer ships, join her on a one-way voyage to the Omega Cluster. Lords of Space, Katerina as the first sovereign of the world, with Drake as her prince consort. He didn't know what he'd have said to that demand, but he knew in his heart that he'd wanted her to ask. He returned slowly to his seat. "I want your ship," she said. "Not you, not your crew. They can do what they'd like. But Starship Blackbeard, I want it."
Drake blinked. "Are you serious?"
"Quite. Once you have paid Paradis, Aquilar, and my sister, your ship will be your only remaining asset. I figure it is worth £50,000.
£100,000 at least.
Sure, if you wanted to build it from scratch. But if you needed to sell it in the yards of San Pablo or Leopold, you could get about £50,000.
"And you want it for what?" he asked, unable to commit to this demand.
"For my flagship, of course. I'll bribe my sister with Orient Tiger so she'll help me raise the rest of the money I need, and then put one of my people at the helm of Outlaw in turn. Probably Da Silva, he's ready."
Katerina smiled.
"Or, if you think you can raise £50,000, or find some equivalent ship to give me, then you may keep Blackbeard."
Drake stared at her as the implications sank in. It was the same thing she'd asked a moment earlier, except now she'd clarified her demands. Blackbeard would be collateral. What Katerina had done, and cleverly, was walk back from their fight. It all sounded reasonable when she put it this way. He would pay her off and promise something as collateral if he couldn't deliver. His earlier anger now felt self-righteous and hypocritical. "Yes," he said quietly, "that is a fair offer on your part."
She reached across the table and put a hand on his arm. "Are we good, James?"
"We're good."
"I don't regret what we did, becoming lovers. It was pleasant. And I'm glad we spent those moments in each other's arms. I will always recall them happily, no matter what happens in the future."
"I don't regret it either," he said truthfully. The only part he regretted was how she spoke of it in the past tense.
"Good. Well, you have my ship and crew. They are at your full disposal. I hope you will put us to good use."
The older sister, Isabel Vargas, was next to arrive on Blackbeard. The entire fleet was hurtling through space at several thousand miles a second, and there was nearly a mistake in the calculations of the slingshot-type system that would get her from one ship to the next. Had that happened, the older Vargas sister would have sailed off, never to be seen again. But some alert person in engineering noted that the numbers didn't sound right, and they corrected the error before the pod launched. Isabel arrived in the war room, already looking put out. She studied Drake with her artificial eye, focusing and refocusing, and then turned to her sister.
"So you've decided to stick around and help your lover after all?"
Katerina snorted.
"What do you know?" "I know the two of you have been together," Isabel said with a grin. "People talk, and I know